Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at armorall.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Martin Lee, and this is the Autosport Podcast. For me, a great achievement was when I won the Formula One World Championship at Monza. I won the race, and I won the championship. Those are the words of Emerson Fittipaldi in a previous podcast we did for the Race of My Life series. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. You can have a listen to that show after this one. Well, we may be a few days into 2023, but just before Christmas at the end of last year, I sat down with Autosport's chief editor, Kevin Turner, to talk about one of the records in Formula One which took decades to break, and that is Emerson Fittipaldi's, his World Championship drive with Lotus. And there's a whole bunch of celebrations which kicked off around the 50th anniversary of that actual event, of the actual race in Italy, a few months ago. And those celebrations are continuing. Lotus, the car maker, these days owned by the Chinese company Geely, have unveiled a tribute vehicle to Emerson Fittipaldi and that win 50 years ago. He dominated the 1972 season in the Lotus 72D, becoming the youngest ever Formula One world champion. As we've just had the 50th anniversary of that incredible record-breaking win, let's talk about it with our chief editor Kevin Turner. Was it man, was it machine, or a combination of both? How did he do it, and why did it take so long to break that record that stood? Let's find out. Get up to speed with Kevin now. Let's join Kevin when I spoke to him just before Christmas in our office in London, and he seemed pretty happy about talking about something from 50 years ago.
Oh yeah, this is right in my this is right down my street. This, I was very pleased when you emailed me about this. I'm going, how do you fancy having a chat about 1972 in Emerson? Yes please. Yes, let's do that.
Well, of course, the reason that I saw it was the 50th anniversary, and Lotus, the car company as it is these days, were releasing a special edition of one of their road cars. I forget which one, but it brought to mind, yes, we missed the actual anniversary earlier this year, but it is indeed 50 years when Formula One gained a new world champion, younger than any before.
this kid from Brazil that many people might have thought had kind of come from nowhere, but indeed he hadn't, because he'd been racing in the UK and here in Europe. We're going to find out his story of how he got there and then how he won. So let's build up to that. What was his path in motorsport? How did he end up in UK and European racing series long before Formula One?
Well, yeah, I mean, in those days, you know, the UK was where you came to get your career started. Obviously, Formula Ford had started, just in 1967, and that very quickly became, you know, the place for aspiring racing drivers to be. MO came over to do that and did the usual climbing up the back when it was a bit more of a straightforward ladder. Although, to be fair, the FIA have tried to make that more sensible in recent years. But yeah, so he came up the UK ranks. He was known, so in European circles, yeah, very early. And of course, he was the first sort of big name Brazilian to come across. He sort of paved the way for Nelson Piquet and Ayrton Senna to come along later on. But the thing that sort of thrust him, I think the reason, if you like, that we're talking about him as the youngest world champion until Fernando Alonso took that off him, was because of what happened at Lotus. So obviously he started off in the old Lotus 49 in 1970 as kind of almost the second or third string car to Jochen Rindt. In the late 72, winning the championship, and then Jochen was killed at Monza, and really MO stepped up and won his fourth World Championship Grand Prix in the US Grand Prix, which also clinched the championship for Jochen because it meant Jackie Ickx couldn't catch him, and suddenly he was team leader. So it was this kind of rapid rise and then the loss of his, you know, and I believe Jochen was very helpful to MO. In his early days, he speaks very highly of him. But yes, so suddenly there you are, you're young Brazilian and you're leading the world championship winning Formula One team.
And he was very young because he won the world championship, like I say, when he was 25 years old. And that would stand for decades until Fernando Alonso came along. And then that record has changed hands a few times since then. But it stood for so, so long. Tell me about that car then, the Lotus 72D. So he wasn't new to Formula One that year, and that car, that chassis, that engine, tell us a little bit about that and what kind of machinery was he driving as he came into 72?
Well, so the Lotus 72, we did a piece on this a couple of years back where we kind of decided it was the greatest competition car of all time. It's not sort of a game changing quite the same way that, say, the Lotus 49 was with the DFV and stress member, but it sets the template for what a single seater looks like, you know, that chisel nose, radiator on the side. But it had a very interesting life. So it had all sorts of weird and wonderful anti-squat, anti-dive suspension. It didn't really work when it first came out. Rindt hated driving it. But they worked away. When MO got hold of it into in 1970, it was obviously it won the championship, so it was kind of there. But then it was thrown by 1971. Obviously, he was still inexperienced, probably wasn't ready to fight for the championship at that point. But also, Firestone introduced slick tyres in 1971, and that really changed how the cars used the rubber. So it actually required quite a lot of suspension tweaks to get that slick to work, and of course, some bits were fragile. Lotuses could be a bit fragile, so some bits are broken. In 71, Colin Chapman had got a bit carried away with the Lotus 56B turbine car, which MO did drive. It was like, and he was probably right to be a bit, and I think over the winter into 72, they had new funding from John Player Special, so they went from that cool gold leaf livery to an even cooler black and gold JPS livery. They got the suspensions altered. They got it working on the tyres. MO was ready. So if you look at the end of 71, actually, they are beginning to pick up results. So the kind of the signs were there.
Right.
They were quite evenly matched, the Lotus, with the Ferrari and the Tyrrell in 72 in terms of raw pace. But the Lotus was just a much better overall race car, I think.
And all these years later, we're still talking about tyres as a central issue in Formula One, but it was no different in 1971-72. Was there anything about his age, his lack of experience almost, in that he was perhaps more malleable, adaptable to driving cars, unlike some of the older drivers who were perhaps a little slower to learn? Or is that not the case?
I think it depends on the individuals, but certainly if you look at MO's career, yeah, adaptable is probably fair to say was one of his strengths, because look, you know, once his F1 career ended, he went off to IndyCar, won the Indy 500 and the IndyCar Championship. So I think it's down to the individual abilities and their willingness to go with it. I think he formed a pretty strong relationship with Colin Chapman as well. Maybe not quite the Clark-Chapman thing, but I think even Colin said, because Emo talked about this when we interviewed him, Colin said, I've got close to drivers before and it's painful when things go wrong, and they get killed, because obviously he'd lost Clark and Rindt quite close together. So I think it was the right person, right team, right time. But I think also we should probably mention, you might be getting onto it, Martin, but Jackie Stewart, the other opportunity that comes along in 1972 is that, Jackie Stewart by the end of 71 is the best driver in the world, I think probably without any question. Once Rindt's killed, there's not, Emo's the coming guy, Jackie Ickx is probably the next one, he's quite close. Pedro Rodriguez until he was killed in 71. So Stewart is the king coming into 72. But a combination of, I think, the Lotus being better, Emo being ready for it, and of course, Jackie got a duodenal ulcer during the year. So if you look at a couple of his performances before he misses the French Grand Prix, I think it is. That's where he returned. So he missed the Belgian Grand Prix. He has a couple of uncharacteristic errors, not really on it, not feeling well. He misses a race. So I'm not in any way trying to put a damper on Emo's championship campaign, but I think that gives an opportunity. But I did do some stats I think you'll like. I went through each race by race to work out who was ahead of who in their head-to-head before mechanical intervened or they finished. And of the nine races that I thought you could make a call on, it was 5-4 to Emo. So that's a deserving champion. But interestingly, when Stewart comes back from the French Grand Prix, the number of points he and Emo score is exactly the same. So they're absolutely neck and neck. Autocourse and Autosport both put Stewart at number one in their driver ratings at the end of the year. But Emo took the title. I think that's probably fair. They were quite head and shoulders above the others. Ickx was good in the Ferrari, but it didn't finish enough races, wasn't consistent enough.
You mentioned Colin Chapman. A final word on him and the Lotus. Of course, he had a reputation for building a car which would get to the flag and just get to the flag. That was his philosophy of why would you have a car that would do any more than it needs to do, and perhaps have a reputation for fragility in places. But what that car had evolved to a stage of, what was the reliability like in the 72 season? How did that benefit Emerson Fittipaldi?
Yeah, it was pretty good. It was pretty on a par for the time. Like, they weren't as reliable, those cars, as we come to expect them now. But it was on a par with the others. I think that was a combination of Lotus being able to turn their attention back to the 72 after the turbine.
Yeah.
The turbine thing. Beefing up things for the suspension and sorting it out with the tyres. Because obviously with a slick tyre, you're putting more load through everything. So even if you had a reliable car, you're suddenly putting more through it, and you're finding new things to break. And as you say, Chapman was always towards the add lightness quote. He was always, if he could get away with something that thin, then he would get away with it. So, but I think by then they'd honed the car enough to, it was thin, but it was thick enough. And I think, I don't think Emo was ever known as a car breaker. Kind of a nice, smooth, him and Ronnie Peterson, obviously the teammates. The following year, you had Emo that could set the car up and was kind of almost the mature head at that point, even though Ronnie had joined at the same time. Ronnie would drive it sideways but faster. And they were a great sort of combination, really, although they both ended up losing the championship. I think by 72, the car was ready. Emo loved it. It was the car he picked as his best car. Yeah, best car of his whole career. He comes back to drive the old cars. In fact, you mentioned the Lotus launch a month or two ago. Yeah. They actually also, classic team Lotus, Clive Chapman, Colin's son, they got all the existing Lotus 72 chassis together for that, and they gathered them together. Fans, I was hoping to go to that, but unfortunately couldn't in the end. But seen some brilliant photos of Emo there with all the 72s behind him, which is really very, very cool. And bearing in mind that he also won the world championship in the McLaren M23, which is another great F1 design, I think that gives you an idea of just how at one he felt with that car.
You always want to beat your teammate as the first person because they're in equal machinery. So who was his teammate in 72?
It was Dave Walker.
Who?
Exactly.
Our listeners are asking,
now,
who?
His is an interesting story that I'd really like to know more about. So this is a challenge for me for the future, perhaps. But yeah, he was quite highly rated coming up through the ranks, like most of them are when they get to F1. But he had an awful season. I think maybe there are times when, obviously, you build yourself around your best asset, don't you, as a team. So maybe he got all the love, but I'm sure Lotus mechanics and people at the time would say, well, no, that's not why it happened. But he didn't, I don't think he scored a point. He barely, he could barely finish in the top 10. I think if it was on 2022 scoring, he'd have scored 3 points.
Destroyed by his teammates, and then left Formula One.
Yeah,
and after that season,
they put Rainey Vassell in for a couple of races, who I think probably did a better job. Was kind of actually he was a sort of a rival, if you like, compatriot of Ronnie Peterson, who then joined the team and then suddenly had two number ones in the team, which eventually put Emo's nose out of joint. Not because of anything Ronnie did. They got on famously because I think everyone loved Ronnie Peterson. Dave Walker, yeah, it's a sort of a sad story, really.
Absolutely.
For whatever reason, it just didn't happen for him when he got his chance in F1.
Right, coming up on the podcast, we will find out how the 72 season went and what eventually won it and made Emerson Fittipaldi a record breaker, and find out about a crash on the way to the track in Italy that had some of the Italian fans even stealing parts of the car from the roadside. What? That story's on the way. Stick around. All right, welcome back to the podcast. Let's get into the 72 season then. I mean, it wouldn't even get you to the summer break these days. 12 races and half as many as we're heading towards next year. And his record was 5 wins and 3 podiums, which was enough in 72 to completely dominate. These days, it wouldn't. But coming off the back of what Verstappen's just done. But that was, in 72, that was a proper domination of a season until he won, because he didn't score anything after Italy.
Yeah, no, he didn't. But you say domination, but I mean, obviously, Stewart did win 4 times.
Of course, yeah, of course.
Having missed one race, and as I say, I think been ill for at least one, possibly two. There were 16 points between them at the time, and I think it was 9 points for a win. So, yeah, I mean, we're not talking domination Max Verstappen 2022
style. No, not at all. No.
But yeah, I mean, it was just to clinch it in a 12-race season with 2 rounds to go, is pretty good. I mean, early on in the season, Emo and Jackie kind of, they both had a reasonable start in terms of pace. Stewart won the first race in Argentina. Emo retired but was second in South Africa and then won in Spain. So, you know, it was a fairly even start. But then there's that middle campaign at Monaco. Emo gets a third place behind the Jean-Pierre Beltoise masterclass. Mm. But Beltoise is never going to be a championship contender. So that's a bonus. Obviously, Emo then won the Belgian Grand Prix when Stewart wasn't there. Stewart won the French Grand Prix. But I think one of the best races of the season, and I'd like to put it to Emo that this arguably was a better drive than his race of my life. I think he picks that for other reasons.
Yeah.
But the British Grand Prix, which is a three-way fight between Ix, Stewart and Fittipaldi. So the three drives of the year.
Mm.
And it's proper, flat-out, chasing each other for the entire length of the race. A little bit of overtaking as well, I think. And Emo comes out on top. And to beat that company, that's a proper, when you've got to deliver, you deliver. Which for a guy who's only in his, second full season of F1 against a guy who's already double world champion, I think that's his standout race of the season.
Can you explain back in the 70s what dropped points were and why it wasn't as simple as going to a race, the first 6 races of the year, scoring your points and going away with that's what you've got? How did the point system work back then?
Oh, confusingly and ridiculously. And they kept changing it as well.
Yes.
From year to year, they did different things. Sometimes it was ridiculous. So for that that particular season, the best 5 results from your first 6 races counted, and then the best 5 results from the second half of the season counted. Now, quite often that means you wouldn't actually drop points, because in those days you'd probably have a retirement in either half of the season. But it did mean that if you had, let's say you had four wins, a second and a third in the first half of the season, your third wouldn't count for anything. So those 4 points wouldn't, as it would have been then, 4 points wouldn't count.
Mm.
And your 2 halves of the season are added together.
Brilliant.
Now, it got even more complicated in the late 70s and early 80s before they went, do you know what, should we just count all the races?
Count the points.
Which I think was sanity, really. But actually, if you look at the 72 championship points, I don't think anyone dropped any points.
Wow.
It's that drop points has only changed the outcome of the title twice. Here's a fun little fact.
Right.
1964.
Yeah.
Graham Hill would have won the World Championship rather than John Surtees if they weren't drop points. So he would have won by one instead of lost by one.
Yeah.
And more controversially, perhaps, 1988, the Senna-Prost year. Prost scored more points than Senna, but lost on the dropped scores rule.
Well, there we go. Only twice. Before we get to Italy, let's just talk through the season. Any races that you want to pick out or highlight? You mentioned Silverstone already. Anything else, or should we just get to the decider?
I think the one that stands out to me, as I say, is the British Grand Prix, really. So I'm happy. Well, I like talking about Monaco 72, but that's a wet classic, which I talk about all the time. So we should probably let's talk about Monza,
and let's talk about how they were getting there. Now, in the Race of My Life interview that we did, he said, "I couldn't believe it. Here I was going to the championship decider, and the truck crashes on the freeway 60 miles before Milano." And then myself and Peter War drove on. We saw spare parts on the grass everywhere. The Italians were trying to grab them as souvenirs. The team were just trying to stop them. I looked at that scene and I couldn't believe this was my car. A few days before, I was going to decide my world championship. So a heck of a story before you even get there. And I think before the race, he had a fuel leak as well. It was like the omens weren't looking good, you know.
I think that's probably why he picks it as the race of his life. I think, for me, Race of My Life is, because I can be that bit removed from it and I try and be less emotional.
Yeah.
Which is stupid because it's like, you know, kind of enthusiast, we love it all. But I try and be like, what was your best drive is kind of what I mean. And that's why I picked out his brand's hatch win, the British Grand Prix. But I think from an emotional perspective, it's the truck crash, the fuel leak on the grid, the car wasn't working in practice, Ferraris are very quick, home of Ferrari, the Tifosi, you know, you're pretty unpopular if you're not driving a Ferrari normally. And everything was against him. So to then not only clinch the championship, but to win the race as well, become the youngest world champion. I think his dad was commentating on it as well.
He was for Brazilian radio.
Yeah, which is really cool. Imagine like having your dad commentate as you win the world championship. Like that's pretty amazing. So you can kind of see why he's picked. I mean, as a race, it wasn't particularly remarkable.
Yeah.
He was the next best behind the Ferrari. He chased the Ferraris. The Ferraris broke. He won. So if you were doing a top 10 list of Emerson Fittipaldi drives, which of course I am.
quick plug for a future.
Actually, I don't know when I'll get it done, but I'd like to speak to him about it actually. But that's a work in progress. But it wouldn't be my number one choice for him, which makes sound a bit presumptuous. But I mean, purely from the driving point of view, but as in a holistic look at the story of this ridiculous weekend from road crash with the truck to fuel leak to championship victory is a remarkable story.
And tell us a little more about how that race went, because he was going into it knowing that it was the possibility he'd break the record, youngest world champion. How did the Grand Prix pan out? You've mentioned it a little bit already, but
yeah, well, as I say, it was one of those weekends where the Ferrari season was quite an odd one. I mean, which year am I talking about, listener? It could be almost any. But yeah, so obviously they usually, you know, in those days, Ferrari usually had a really good engine, either V12 or in this case a flat 12, which round now Monza, of course, this was the first year of the chicanes, so because 71 had been that incredible slipstreaming Peter Gethin fastest race record. And I think even F1 in the 70s, they went, oh, that's a bit quick, isn't it? 150 mile an hour average.
Yeah.
So I just put some chicanes in, which of course everyone hated, as they still do.
Yes.
It wasn't a great practice. Jack Hicks was on pole in the Ferrari. Chris Amon, V12 Matra, was second. Jackie Stewart, back on form, the quickest of the DFV runners in third. Then another Ferrari, and then Denny Holm in the McLaren, which actually that's a pretty good effort because he wasn't much of a qualifier. Mm. So anyway, Emo was sixth on the grid, although only 6/10 off pole, so not a huge disaster. He ran in the top three, so although he qualified sixth, his race pace was better, as it was most of the season. Mm. And then he inherited the lead in the last 10 laps. Ix led, then Regazzoni, then Ix again, and then by lap 46 both Ferraris had broken and Emo was left in the lead and brought it home 14 and a half seconds clear it was in the end of Mike Hailwood. So there's another legend name, but on two wheels, legendary name on two wheels in the Surtees. It wasn't a sort of fantastic fight through the field or a virtuoso drive in the wet or a toe-to-toe fight with Stewart like the Brands race.
Yeah,
but it's the emotional thing, isn't it? It's getting the job done, becoming world champion.
And there he was, the youngest world champion, a record that would stand for decades afterwards until Fernando Alonso came along, who was himself pretty special. What was that like afterwards once he had won the, you know, the world championship? Because he actually had a terrible end to the season, scored no more points. And then where did his career go after that?
Well, it's interesting. Sometimes that happens, doesn't it? We've even seen it with Lewis Hamilton a few times when he's got the championship won. Perhaps a pre-2017 version.
Yeah.
When he'd get the championship won and then it just... I'm sure it's not a conscious thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Emo just didn't get to, you know, didn't get to the end of the last two races, healthily anyway. And Stewart kind of put his marker down for the following season by winning the last two Grand Prix. And I guess that's what makes the challenger points closer. So perhaps I was being a bit unfair to you earlier yes. to say it wasn't domination. So I apologise to that, Martin. but yeah, so into 73, you know, all looks good. I still maintain that the Lotus 72 is the best car in 1973.
Right.
Jackie Stewart agrees with me.
Does he?
I also think the McLaren M23 was better than his Tyrrell, but he disagrees with me on that. whereas the M23 didn't have a top liner in those days. You know, Denny Holm was a former world champion, but was never the fastest. And Peter Revson was kind of an up-and-coming, but not quite top draw guy. And you had Fittipaldi and Peterson in the Lotus and Francois Sever and Stewart in the Tyrrell, which is quite a tricky car to drive. Lotus should have won that championship, but Ronnie wasn't. Now, Ronnie was a combination, not quite up to speed early on, and then unfortunately unreliability when Emo had a brilliant run, and then it was the other way around in the second half of the year, and Stewart just did what I believe is one of the great series. We should do a podcast on 73. But at the end of that season at Monza, Stewart is putting what he thinks is his greatest drive, coming through the field after a punch to finish fourth. Emo's in second, shadowing teammate Peterson, waiting for the pre-agreed strategy, which is Colin Chapman to get Ronnie to step aside, let Emo take the lead and win to keep the championship alive going to the next race. And the call never came.
Right.
And Emo wasn't cross with Ronnie because Ronnie was just doing what Ronnie did. He's like, I'm leading the race until I get told otherwise.
Yeah.
And we know from what happened with Ronnie alongside Mario Andretti later on that Ronnie was a very, very straight, honest. He would do what he agreed to. You know, there was no duplicity there at all. So Emo was never, I think he got on very well with Ronnie. I don't think there was any problem there. But he wasn't happy with Colin not doing that. And he wasn't happy with the response after. It was kind of a shrug of the shoulders. And the result was that Emo left and took his Marlborough money to McLaren. So quite a key moment, really, in most ways, given how long Marlborough was then with McLaren. And then won the 1974 World Championship with McLaren, which must have been quite satisfying. he was then probably one of the main rivals to Niki Lauda as Lauda and Ferrari got going in 75. But then he obviously joined his brother's Fittipaldi Copasuka sponsored team, and that was a bit of a disaster. The car was not competitive, so Emo very as quickly as he rose he fell from sight in F1 terms, but as I say, then he went across to America and had a fantastic career there and was still winning and fighting Nigel Mansell late as the 1990s for Indy 500 wins and the championship and all that sort of thing. So yeah, remarkable man, incredible career. But and I think that's why it's so kind of cool that he still picks out the Lotus 72 as his greatest racing car, because that's a guy that's driven some cool kit, including one of the great Indy cars, the 94 Penske.
So
he's got I'm obsessed with lists. This is the problem. If he was doing a list of his best cars, it'd be a good list to go through.
Well, I think we've got some future podcasts in there as well. As normally happens when we do a show, we've got four more to do. Well, there we go. Thank you very much. That is our show for today. I was also wondering about, is there a podcast in people who have commentated on motor races related to the people in the race? Because I'm also thinking of Daryl Waltrip in NASCAR, who commentates famously, and brother Michael, who won Daytona in 2001, that famous clip of him going, come on Mikey, because the race that Dale Earnhardt passed away. But you think there's got to be examples in motorsport of commentating on your family members, or maybe not. If anyone's listening, let me know.
It's niche, but I mean, I'm sure Martin Brundle will have commentated on Alex racing somewhere,
or maybe not. Maybe that's the only examples. There must be more examples.
There must be.
Email us, podcast@autosport.com, and do my research for me.
And then what's going to happen, wonderful listeners, if you get enough long enough list, Martin, do you want to do a podcast on sons or daughters of, or fathers and mothers of drivers that commentated?
Well, there we go. That's our show for the day. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you on the next one.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The is it morning yet deal. How about now? Or now? Because morning time is McDonald's breakfast time. And that's the best time of all the times.
Wake up with a little splash of sweetness. Get any size iced coffee from caramel to hazelnut to French vanilla for just 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Sports Social Podcast Network.